Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Those of you who are having a hard time finding a seat, our apologies. There are nevertheless seats available, I can see from here. The name of this session is Sticks and Stones and Elvin's Bones, a discussion of Michael Quinn's early Mormonism and the magic worldview. We have essentially a panel discussion. We have four participants. Listed on the program is William A. Wilson, commonly known as Bert Wilson, a folklorist at BYU. Brother Wilson was unable to be with us today. He just underwent surgery and is recuperating. He will nevertheless be giving a paper this Saturday, and he would very much have liked to have been here. Immediately to my right as a panelist is Stephen D. Ricks, an associate professor of Hebrew and Semitic languages at Brigham Young University. He is a member of the board of directors of the Foundation of Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. He took his Ph.D. in Near Eastern Religions at UC Berkeley in the Graduate Theological Union. He is leaving in a couple of days with his wife and children to go to Jerusalem to teach at the Jerusalem Center, BYU. He has six children who will go with him, which is really remarkable. To Steve's immediate right is C. Jess Grossbeck, M.D. He has an interest in psychiatry and psychoanalysis and has practiced those professions in San Francisco and also forensic psychiatry. He has long held an interest in psychohistorical research based upon the writings basically of Jung, Freud, and other psychoanalytic writers. He is writing a book on primitive healing, shamanism, and modern psychotherapy. He married the former Sharon Wilde. They have five remarkable children, whom he asserts keep him in this world of reality. That's disputable, of course. Immediately to Jess's right is Kent E. Robeson. Dr. Robeson is professor of philosophy at USU. He's the chairman or head of the Department of Languages and Philosophy, and he took his Ph.D. in philosophy at Stanford University. Immediate to Kent's right is Richard D. Pohl. Richard Pohl is a professor emeritus of history at Western Illinois University. He's a native of Salt Lake City. He received a B.A. and M.A. degree at Texas Christian University and a Ph.D. in history at the University of California, Berkeley. He taught history at Brigham Young University for 22 years before going to WIU in 1970 as vice president for administration. He is a co-editor of Utah History and with Eugene E. Campbell is the co-author of Hubie Brown, His Life and Thought. He has served in the church as a branch president and high councilman. His article, quote, What the Church Means to People Like Me, unquote, has appeared in two anthologies in the last year. Since retiring in 1983, he has lived in Provo with his wife, Emma Jean, who is with him today. They are the parents of three children and seven grandchildren. We have a remarkable panel. The format that we will follow is this. Each panelist, beginning immediately with Steve, and then going to Jess, Kent, and finally to Richard, will give us an opening statement at this pulpit of 5 to 7 minutes. Thereafter, we will give each a chance to respond to the remarks of the others. The remarks will be addressed essentially to assessing, critiquing, and analyzing a recent book written by Michael D. Quinn. And without further ado, I'll turn the time over to Steve Ricks. My name, by the way, is Blake Osler. I'm the panelist. And after all that's done, you will be allowed to ask questions, and I will play God and choose who gets to ask the questions.
D. Michael Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, like other works by Quinn, has a fluid style and reflects deep erudition. However, if I have found it an often enlightening and frequently suggestive book, I have also found it puzzling at points. Quinn says in his introduction that he has adopted Webster's New International Dictionary definition as a guide for the use of the term magic and the occult. He cites Webster's definition of the occult and magic. The definition of magic that he cites is as follows. It is the use of means such as ceremonies, charms, spells, and so forth that are believed to have supernatural power to cause a supernatural being to produce or prevent a particular result, such as rain, death, or healing, considered not obtainable by natural means, and that also include the arts of divination, incantation, sympathetic magic, which he further defines as magic based on the assumption that a person or thing can be supernaturally affected through its name or an object, such as nail paring, image, or dancer, which represents it. Further, magic can be thaumaturgy, which is the performance of miracles, the control of natural forces by the typically direct action of rites, objects, materials, or words considered supernaturally potent, and extraordinary power or influence seemingly from a supernatural source. It can further be something that seems to cast a spell or to give an effect of otherworldliness, such as an enchantment. That then for the Webster's dictionary definition. Further, he wishes to indicate what he means by magic in magic worldview. He defines magic worldview with four additional characteristics. First, a lack of distinction between the lifeless and the living, a sort of animism. Second, a belief that certain words, signs, numbers, and objects are in themselves powerful, even if they also represent something else. Third, a belief in a chain of causation, that is, seeing nothing as simply accidental. And fourth, a sense of satisfaction or a feeling of the rationality of these actions. Based then on his definition that he has said has influenced him in his use of the term magic, that is Webster's, as well as these further refinements on what he understands by the magic worldview, we can begin to ask ourselves how it actually works out in reality. It seems to me that even casual reflection on some of the most normative aspects of the most normative of Western religious traditions then such as Judaism and Christianity in its major forms, have rites that could easily be construed to fit Webster's definition of magic, and further may have beliefs that correspond to Quinn's further refinements of the magic worldview. I simply give as two or three examples transubstantiation in Catholicism, which could easily, given a person's will to do so, be construed as magic based on the definition that is given in Webster's. The notion of rationality or a sense of satisfaction, I think one would have to say, is a characteristic of every religious tradition. In fact, rationality lies at the heart of activity in religion as in other things. As Professor Hans Penner at Dartmouth recently noted in a paper that he read on methodology in magic, science, and religion. One wonders then what may distinguish magic from religion. A very difficult problem. And in his introduction, as well as in the first chapter of the book, Quinn recognizes by the numerous sources that he cites the problems that one confronts in attempting to distinguish the one from the other. Yet, throughout the book, it appears that Quinn persists in describing certain activities as magic or as magical, and in using this term, magic worldview. I ask myself, as I read that then, on the basis of what criteria has he determined that certain actions are magic or magical, while others implicitly are not? He has given us no calculus, so far as I can see, to establish that. There must be one. If it is true, and it seems to be, that there is no clear distinction between magic and religion, except as it reflects the attitudes or biases of specific individuals, then we need to know what his attitudes and biases are in order to understand how he has used the term magic. So far as I can see, he has not done that. Though I don't see it explicitly stated, it appears that he is allowing the assumptions of Enlightenment rationalism to guide him. I see that as useful in those instances where one is speaking descriptively, that is, of an historical situation, and noting how individuals at a particular period of time may have viewed others and others' practices. I see that as highly problematical when we begin using that same kind of distinction without at least giving the reader some kind of guidance into how the two terms are used. As Professor Penner, whom I mentioned before, also stated in this paper that he wrote on methodological considerations of magic, science, and religion, since there is no objective criteria for distinguishing magic from ritual, magic as a classificatory term is useless. Now, as a term, as I have said, to describe how individuals and peoples in history have viewed themselves and have viewed themselves vis-a-vis others, the term magic retains its usefulness, as it might be used by a social scientist or a person in the humanities in the 20th century to describe the activities of individuals either in this period of time or another, becomes highly problematical for the reason that I have just noted. You cannot, on the basis of any objective criteria that doesn't reek or at least have the scent of some kind of cultural or religious imperialism, distinguish between magic and ritual or magic and religion. In some ways, though I will allow that the term magic retains a usefulness in historic descriptions, I see or feel that the term is worse than useless in descriptions of the same activities where it is from an individual of the 20th century looking at other individuals, especially from a different period of time, for two reasons. Not only because there is no objective criteria by which you can do it, but secondly, and I think equally importantly, because inevitably there is a certain sense of a certain pejorative sense that is to be found in the connotation of the word. Thus, I think departing from the standards of objectivity that social science disciplines at least espouse, if not actually practice. It seems to me that other, less value-laden terms might also be used with more profit and ultimately with less misunderstanding. Words such as religion or popular religion, if one will, or even folk religion. These words, I think, are sufficiently ambiguous in the mind of the listener that it is possible for the writer to load them with the meaning by that he intends them to have. My second point, I find Quinn's attempted rehabilitation of the salamander somewhat odd. Although there are no authentic documents explicitly linking Joseph Smith of the early period of Mormonism to the figure of the salamander, a point that Quinn himself makes, and although the one document that was supposed to have linked the salamander with that early period of Mormonism, which has now been shown to be a forgery, as Quinn notes, Quinn spends several pages showing how perfectly proper it would be to have a salamander in Mormonism's past. Although I am sympathetic with his desire, I think his desire, what I am reading as his desire to substitute the neutral to positive image of the salamander for the negative and sinister image of the toad that is mentioned in certain documents of early Mormon history, there is, so far as we can say right now, simply no evidence for it in the documents. Further, it needs to be pointed out that the exhaustive treatment of the treasure digging motif in America that was done some years ago by the late Wayland Hands student has turned up no trace of a salamander in American folklore in connection with treasure digging. There's nothing there. There are lots of other figures. The salamander simply doesn't appear. Why should we expect it then to appear in early Mormon documents? As a third and final point, I have found some of Quinn's explanations illuminating and his erudition on the subject, on the general subject, very impressive. However, as I continued reading, I first of all asked myself how in the world Joseph Smith could actually have known all of the things that he would need to have known in order to have made the connections that Quinn suggests. Further, I asked myself, in light of Quinn's own stated testimony of the gospel, why he was constantly seeking environmental explanations for things that already had a more traditional explanation. Explanations such as the name of Moroni and so forth, which he can also find in the vastnesses of the Kabbalistic past. The picture I sometimes feel irresistibly coming through in this book, and one that I felt the need to resist, was one of Joseph not as a hired hand, a farmhand on the early American frontier, but rather of a polymath Renaissance magus, bedecked in a starry robe. Aren't there simpler explanations for some of the things that we find in the early Mormon, early period of Mormonism, including the most traditional explanation for crying out loud?
This way I know that when I say something, someone else hasn't said it before.
An alternate title to this discussion, Sticks and Stones in Alvin's Bones, might be Uncovering the Cover Story. Michael Quinn, one of the leading Mormon historians in this book, asked those who are seriously and vitally interested in Mormonism to take another step. That step is to delve into and to observe another world, and hence another view of Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. I would say that it is an invitation or a call to examine Joseph Smith as shaman or seer. I think Quinn's comes closest to summing up what he was trying to do in this book on page 49 at the end of chapter 5 when he says, "Thus the transformation of Joseph Smith Jr. from farm boy to seer from 1820 to 1830 was marked by revelation, adventure, anticipation, personal loss, frustration, and finally triumph. Central to the meaning of these years for him, his family, and associates was the intertwining of what others have separated into distinct categories of divine and occult, religious and magical. The translation of the Golden Place to the Book of Mormon began the modern publication of the new scripts, which, like the Bible, echoed for a time a magic worldview that would eventually diminish in the church he organized." I would like to take that frame Quinn leaves us with and state that what I see is not only Joseph Smith as a shamanic or seeric personality, but this whole process, this period between 1820 and 1830, was one in which we see virtually played out the archetypal pattern of initiation for an ancient or modern-day shaman. And what do I mean by shaman? A shaman is a term that comes from to us from anthropology. The shaman was basically a seer, a holy man who had direct visionary or trance experiences with the unknown powers that be, the gods, the devils. He was a medicine man, but not all medicine men are shamans. Priests are not shamans. Priests have contact with the divine through ritual, through other means. Even some kinds of prophets have contact with God somewhat indirectly. A shaman is that individual who has these direct other world experiences in an attempt to reconcile the contradictions in this world. A seer could be said to be the same thing. Let me just review briefly just a few highlights that I think Quinn points to that I think are most intriguing in this book. In my opinion, the highlight of the book comes with Quinn's fifth chapter in discussing the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. For almost the very heart of Mormonism is touched and is looked at in an almost entirely different light by the data that he pulls together. Beginning with the earliest accounts of Smith's visions in 1823, there was the coming of a dream three times, or was it a vision? Quinn documents an enormous amount of data surrounding these early events that are so critical to Mormon history. He discusses the concept of angels and spirits. angels or spirits in remarkable detail. These data we've seldom heard before. About the various visits to the Hill Cumorah by Joseph Smith from 1823 to 27. We hear of early accounts at attempting to get the plates in 1823, in which later accounts omit certain details that were quite significant surrounding the events in Smith's life, such as the failure to keep certain commandments, his desire to obtain riches, and other matters. We hear again of perhaps actual animals, such as toads, and even what we thought had disappeared, the salamander. We hear of strange stories of visits, various visits to the hill, and failures to, and the almost forgotten story of the tragic death of Alvin in the family, and the question of bringing Alvin back to the hill in the second visit in 1824, and even the possibility that his bones were to be exhumed to carry the process out. A very typical, I might add, shamanic story. This of course was led by the Smith family. Finally, we hear new stories of the Urim and Thummim versus the seer stones. Which is it? Their use and what Joseph Smith thought of them. Finally, we hear a little known story of how Joseph Smith was told by the angel to bring Emma, and that may have been an even stronger motivation to marry her in 1826 so that he could be sure to have her there in the final 1827 visit. Again, a typical shamanistic story in which a shaman must have his wife in his spiritual and religious ventures. In addition, we hear of him wearing black clothes and riding a black horse. The book then details this intense otherworldly, animistic, magic worldview. Very different from the Mormon scriptures and other traditional Mormon history we have heard. Finally, Quinn notes the decline of this worldview and how quickly it was left out of official Mormonism, which he himself propagated later in the 1830s. The significance of the book, as I have said, relates to, I think, the invitation now to take a different look at a different Joseph Smith. This is going to be very difficult for many Mormons, for all of us, perhaps from all persuasions. It is an experience that leaves us unsettled, unclear, uncertain, with vague stories that we can't pin down. And yet, if one reads the story of a shaman in his initiation, that is exactly what one finds. In the world painted by Quinn's work, the personal and the magical or the symbolic are all intermingling. This work, however, is long overdue. And in my opinion, it will help us take the next step in understanding Joseph Smith. Speaking now from the point of view of Carl Jung and his psychoanalytic school, he noted that to best understand an individual, three perspectives are necessary. First, the personal. And that we have a lot of in Joseph Smith's life. The personal life of him as a human being. Though I might say, I think even that investigation is just in its infancy. Next, one needs the cultural context. As Jung called it, the cultural unconscious view of an individual. The whole context that molded his life. And third, one needs the archetypal underpinnings of his life. By archetypes, Jung meant, of course, those grand general patterns of behavior that underscore human life in all places and at all times. It is in those patterns, of course, that one begins to understand the meaning of the experiences of God. In my view, Quinn has done a remarkable thing in helping us, particularly with that second position. He's brought us the cultural context, the cultural worldview of Joseph Smith's life. One analyst, Joseph Henderson, made the point that in order to understand a person, one must amplify not only his personal, but all the cultural symbolic dimensions of his life and understand it in great detail. One needs to amplify that. And in so doing, one need not always be concerned that you have exactly a literalistic history about what is happening. And I think that's the great, again, another contribution Mike Quinn's book has made. It has given us that cultural context. And while I think, from what I've heard just initially, many historians may quarrel with some of his data and how he puts it together, I know, speaking as a psychohistorian, a psychoanalytic historian, I think these details are rich and helpful because they help me begin to see Joseph Smith as a person in all of these dimensions. Thank you.
I have great respect for Michael Quinn as a historian. I should tell you, however, that I was profoundly disappointed in this book. The book arises, it seems to me, out of the manuscript that was circulated by Hoffman and has since turned out to be a forgery. And the whole interest in the subject began a couple of years or so ago. And what the book did primarily for me was to persuade me that there just isn't much in the whole magical view that is of great concern to Mormonism. That in fact the preoccupation of some of the intellectuals in the church with magic is misplaced, and if you put it in the whole context of Joseph Smith's contributions, it turns out to be a minuscule and insubstantial part. Now, I offer as evidence for that judgment part of what Quinn himself does in the introduction to the book. He says, I'm going to use four kinds of evidence. I'm going to use Mormon evidence, anti-Mormon evidence, I'm going to use artifacts, and I'm going to use parallel evidence. Let me start with the parallel evidence. He acknowledges that this is evidence that Hugh Nibley has used for years in his work. So if we find something, then let's talk about everything that we can possibly find in whatever language or in whatever source, whether or not we know that it's officially connected with the kind of thing that we're looking at. So if we think that Joseph Smith might have been involved in some magical practice, let's see if there were another magical practice. The problem with parallel evidence is that it might be completely unconnected with the view. So that the most that one can say is, it is plausible that, it is consistent with that, and so on. But you never get any kind of a causal connection that gives you anything firm or hard that you can rely on as evidence. Now, the evidence of parallel evidence is only as good as the source material from where you from whence you get the evidence. Frequently, that source material is itself relatively shaky. And as evidence for that, I want to offer you one judgment that Quinn himself makes in the book on page 103, in which he says, a psychiatrist, and it happens to be my good friend Jess Grossbeck here, has noted that, quote, chronic depression of Joseph Smith Sr. So then you turn to Jess Grossbeck's paper for the evidence that Joseph Smith Sr. suffered chronic depression. And I submit to you that the evidence simply is not there. He suffered economic difficulties, but everybody in my reading of New England suffered economic problems. There were lots of people who were poor, and it's clear that Joseph Smith Sr. and his whole family was poor. It isn't clear, and I don't think the evidence exists to say that he suffered chronic depression. We just don't know that. It's kind of fun for a psychoanalyst to claim that that's the case, but a psychohistorian, psychoanalyst claim that it's the case doesn't make it the case. And when you incorporate that evidence as source material to establish that Joseph Smith Sr. had chronic depression, it just doesn't wash. It doesn't come out. There is no longer any of the tentative nature in Quinn's statement that there was in Grossbeck's statement when he initially made that kind of a claim. So I'm really worried about the parallel evidence. The most extreme example in the book is the attempt to connect Joseph Smith with Winchell and Walters, the Palmyra magician, through parallel evidence. And this is the most bizarre chapter, it seems to me, in the book, where Quinn tries to connect Joseph Smith either by proximity or by relations with everyone who might have been in Vermont at the time of the Woodscape affair. And when he finishes that whole enterprise, there is nothing there. There is no evidence that Joseph Smith knew anything about it, was involved in it, was associated with Winchell or Walters or the people involved in it, and there's just nothing there. So it's an interesting exercise to see what you can make out of something, but when all is said and done, there is nothing left over. Artifacts, the use of artifacts. Now, it's clear that Joseph Smith had some amulets and some parchments, which are called lamans and magical parchments and so on. But, you know, years ago, as I read this book, I remembered that someone years ago gave me a St. Christopher's medal. Now, St. Christopher's medal is supposed to be used to protect people who are traveling. I don't know where that St. Christopher's medal is. I've never worn it. I've never used it. But even if I did, I don't put much stock in it protecting me while I'm traveling. I was talking to one of my neighbors. He has a Mayan calendar on his wall. He has another Mayan calendar on his briefcase. He has two pieces of parchment that he purchased, and I asked him if he knows what either one of them mean, and he indicated to me, no, I really don't. I don't know anything about them, but they're kind of interesting, and so I just acquired them and have kept them for that purpose. You see, never are we able to establish that Joseph Smith had the artifacts that he had for magical purposes. They may have been given to him. They may just incidentally have been in his possessions. But nothing much comes out of that. There is no hard evidence that it played any significant role in the contributions of Joseph Smith. So, what I learned from the book was that after 1827, there is precious little evidence that Joseph Smith had anything to do with magic. The argument is thin, sketchy, tenuous, flimsy, and other words I could use, in order to try to make that connection, and it just doesn't there. Now, the third piece of evidence he uses is anti-evidence. Well, most of that anti-evidence has to do with the very earliest period, and it's clear that Joseph Smith did some treasure digging. But one of the things that I think Quinn should have pointed out but didn't was that he did this often when he was hired to do so and when his family was very poor. Now, even today, if someone would offer me enough money to go out and dig treasures for them, even though I'm not really poor, I'm not rich either, I might go out and dig treasures for them, even though I put absolutely no stock in digging treasures. And if I had a seer stone, I might look in it to try to make them think that this was really a good activity that I'm involved in and that I'm likely to find the treasure that they're looking for. That is, the evidence we have, after you look at all of that evidence, that Joseph Smith was seriously involved in magic just isn't there. So what the book did primarily for me was to convince me that for Joseph Smith, if you put it in the context of his whole contribution, as I think Dick Bushman has done in his book, it's not much. Now, the other thing that Quinn did not do was to try to sort out what contributions of Joseph Smith may have been interpreted by the antis as magical, but were in some sense legitimate. For example, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Now, before 1827, there is some interesting information, even accepting all of the information on magic that one can find, that indicates that Joseph Smith did have a little connection with magic. But if you think of his theophany in 1830, if you think of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and the translation of the Book of Mormon, in all of that, I see relatively little significance to the preoccupation with magic. And in fact, I think there has been some misinterpretation of even friendly sources. And I'd like to just suggest on page 54 a case where that may have occurred. Now, on page 54, as a Mormon source, Quinn quotes from Lucy Mack Smith. And here's what Lucy Mack Smith says. He says, she seemed to confirm, this is Quinn's statement, Lucy Mack Smith seemed to confirm that her family practiced ritual magic. And she did this by this statement. Let not my reader suppose that because I shall pursue another topic for a season, that we stopped our labor and went at trying to win the faculty of Abrek, drawing magic circles or soothsaying to the neglect of all kinds of business. Now, this is interpreted by Quinn to mean that they are involved in the faculty of Abrek, that they are still drawing magical circles and involved in soothsaying. I think that he needs to read the statement more carefully. Let not my reader suppose that we are doing these things. Read the statement carefully, page 54, when you have an opportunity to read the book. I think the whole quotation from Lucy Mack Smith, a favorable source here, is misquoted. Now, a final point or two. It's argued that astronomical dates for Joseph Smith can be found all over the place. Well, for those of you who have looked at magical literature, there are astronomical dates and times for every day, for every person, for any time of the day, and any time of the year. You can find whatever you want to find, even if it had no bearing whatsoever on what Joseph Smith was doing. When all is said and done, aside from learning that magic didn't play a very important role in the whole contribution of Joseph Smith, the other thing that I learned from the book was that Freemasonry didn't either for Mormonism. If you look at all of the evidence, Quinn persuaded me that the contribution of Freemasonry to Mormonism is really not very significant. And I think this is important. Now, one final statement. If you assume that everything that Michael Quinn said in the book, my caveats aside, if you assume that everything he says is true, still, when you put all of that in the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, the organization of the church, the Doctrine and Covenants, and all of his contributions up to 1844 when he was martyred, it seems to me that they amount to very little, precious little, in the whole contributions of Joseph Smith. And that is why I found this book to be disappointing and also frustrating. The evidence simply doesn't support the argument. It's tenuous, scanty, and hard to pin down at every point, primarily by virtue of the same reason that evidence in Hugh Nibley is often scanty, difficult to pin down, and that is, there is no causal connection drawn to Joseph Smith or what he is doing. In fact, I came away from reading the book being persuaded that if anything, probably Brigham Young was more involved in magic than Joseph Smith was. Thank you.
Perceiving that the six-minute rule is handled by my colleagues as a suggestion and not a commandment, I shall read what I have, which I had prepared before I received the suggestion. The complex and subtle relationships and differences between religion and folk magic are epitomized in a story that Gene and I heard while traveling in Ireland after the recent Mormon History Association meetings. Father Murphy, having been transferred to the Vatican, made a final round of visits to his Irish parishioners. Finding Mrs. Casey grieving that she was still childless after several years of marriage, he promised to light a candle for her when he came to St. Peter's. Some years later, he returned and again made the rounds. This time he found Mrs. Casey's cottage wall to wall with children, but no sign of Mr. Casey. "What a lovely brood," he beamed, "but where's your husband?" "Oh, Father Murphy, he's gone to Rome to blow out that damn candle." Let me say at the outset that I was and am impressed by Michael Quinn's scholarship. 65 pages of bibliography, every item of which appears to have been cited at least once in the text, bespeaks months of thoughtful, painstaking investigation. 94 illustrations from at least 30 published archival or private sources should help the reader to make the comparisons that are difficult to visualize from the printed text. My copy had only cut lines, so I look forward to a copy with pictures. The index seems to cover everything. With regard to the 228 pages of text, I found some of it slow going. Quinn has written for, quote, a general readership, he says, attempting, quote, to carefully explain and substantiate topics that might be obvious to readers with more specialized background, end quote. In so doing, he may have engaged in overkill. General readers, no more strongly motivated than I, will be tempted to skip some of the more exotic and heavily annotated portions. His style is cautious and careful, not colorful or provocative. It is understandable that he would choose to package novel and startling interpretations in conservative language, but the result, as literature, is pedestrian. Finally, the interpolation of citations into the body of the text is, in my view, an abomination. The argument of early Mormonism and the magic worldview is, however, challenging, and Quinn makes it, to me, persuasively. Not conclusively, but persuasively. The magic worldview, that all nature is influenced by good and evil forces that respond to rituals, tokens, passwords, and other occult practices, was found in the Joseph Smith family and many of their contemporaries. They brought elements of that view into early Mormonism, and early Mormon scripture, doctrine, and practices reflect some of those elements. Some of Quinn's evidence is direct. One who reads his analysis of the components and possible sources of the markings on Joseph Smith's Jupiter talisman and Hiram Smith's magic parchments is unlikely to dispute what they are, though he may still wonder why the Smith brothers apparently cherished them so long. That members of the Smith family used and believed in the efficacy of divining rods and seer stones long after the church was organized seems beyond dispute, as does Quinn's argument that many early Mormons took astrology very seriously. Some of Quinn's evidence, on the other hand, is flimsy, and here I'm with Kent. His effort to identify the occult mentors who may have introduced the Smith family to seer stones, money digging, and other magic practices involves a series of if this, then that speculations that I found repetitious and unconvincing. Most of Quinn's evidence, as he admits, is Nibley-esque. Like Dr. Hugh Nibley, Mormonism's most prominent scholarly defender of the faith, Quinn uses contemporary parallels to make his points. Quote, "When do seeming coincidences of evidence exceed the probability of coincidence?" he asked in the introduction, quote, "and move toward circumstantial proof."
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time for side two.
It's obvious that Kent and I do. But this study presents evidence that, in my judgment, seems significantly connected, not haphazardly unrelated, end of quote. In most cases, I concur in that judgment. That all scholars of goodwill do not is documented, interestingly enough, not only in Kent's remarks, but in the August issue of The Ensign, in an article entitled "The Alvin Smith Story." Richard L. Anderson looks at the documentation identifying the Smith family with a serious and sustained interest in magic and finds it fragmentary and unconvincing. If there's an institutional response to Quinn's book, it will likely make the same point more tersely. Interesting, but irrelevant. Where this book really breaks new ground is in suggesting specific parallels between the occult literature and lore of early 19th century America and details of Joseph Smith's boyhood epiphany, his 4-year quest for the golden plates, some names and concepts in his inspired writings and the sacred ordinances of the temple. Quinn's handling of Barak Ale, the pseudonym for Smith in the Doctrine and Covenants 103rd and 105th sections, is an intriguing detail in what is, for me, the most interesting chapter in the book, Chapter 6, Mormon Scriptures and the Magic Worldview. Quinn uses Nibley in developing the argument that the temple ordinances reflect occult concepts and the mysteries of antiquity, rather than borrowings from Freemasonry. In stressing that the otherworldly objectives of these rites did not come from Masonry, he seems to me to overlook the probability that the Mormon encounter with Freemasonry in Nauvoo may have contributed to the ritual content of temple work. Illustrative of the intriguing tidbits with which the book abounds is Quinn's suggestion that young Joseph Smith married Emma Hale in order to satisfy the angelic requirement that he bring her with him as his wife in order to obtain the gold plates. Even without the Mark Hoffman forgery, he finds evidence that a salamander may have been part of the Hill Cumorah story. His declaration that, quote, anti-Masonic interpretations of the Book of Mormon fit the context only superficially, end quote, is certainly revisionist. My most serious argument relates to the final chapter, quote, the persistence and decline of magic after 1830. Its last paragraph begins, quote, by the early 20th century, identifiable magic practices and beliefs were not only in decline in the church, they did not exist for the vast majority of Mormons, end quote. By Quinn's own earlier analysis, this conclusion claims too much. In his closely argued introduction, which has partially been quoted already, he acknowledges that the practices of magic and religion, quote, are often outwardly similar, if not identical. He bases his own distinction between the two primarily on the moral dimension. Quote, religion subordinates ritual to group and individual ethics, or at least emphasizes both, but magic gives little or no attention to group ethics and emphasizes individual ethics primarily as another instrument to achieve the desired ends of ritual, close quote. And what are the ends of ritual? To thwart or placate the evil, the diabolical forces, or to please or summon the good, the divine powers that can affect the human condition. Few churches in Christendom have placed more emphasis on ordinances and their ritual packaging than the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the most recent administrative changes at the ward and state level increase that emphasis. Ordinances stand at the point of overlap between the spheres of religion and magic. To the extent that they are purely symbolic, outward signs of an inward grace, they belong to religion. To the extent that they are perceived as having intrinsic merit, as invoking the principle of divine obligation, found in Doctrine and Covenants 82 and 10, and in the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, they incorporate the magic worldview. To the extent that their acceptability is seen to depend on precision of language and technique, details without inherent moral content, that incorporation is more apparent. If seer stones and magic parchments have passed out of fashion, other objects and procedures to which special mystical efficacy is assigned abound. By the terms of the 132nd section, we may still bind heaven by the rituals of the temple, and without these rituals, with their associated symbols, no amount of righteous living can gain exaltation for the living or the dead. Some Mormons still assign magic properties to temple garments, and many more accept stories that ascribe such properties to them. Institutional policy credits prayer with special appropriateness if it employs the language of King James and is spoken in a kneeling position. Prayers for lost treasures are condemned, but petitions for help in finding lost children, lost pocketbooks, or lost thimbles are approved. And many Latter-day Saints believe that their formal utterance adds efficacy to the yearnings of the heart. To light a candle for a sick friend is to flirt with infidelity. But to write the friend's name on a slip of paper and put it in a special place is to enhance one's prayer. It is arguable that liberal Protestantism has lost some of its appeal because it has divested itself of the magic dimension that Quinn and others have shown to be part of the great religions of the past. Contemporary Mormonism shuns the words magic and occult, but hardly their substance. This being the case, early Mormonism and the magic worldview should have a wider audience among Latter-day Saints than it is likely to find. Thank
you. As I indicated earlier, William Wilson will not be with us today because of surgery that he had. He asked me to convey to you, however, that there's a big mistake merely in the title of the book. There is no such thing as a magic worldview. There are magic worldviews, and Michael Quinn has mixed magic worldviews from times and places that are not relevant into one that may have been minimally relevant. I will now turn the time over for a short, mandatory, divinely inspired 3-minute response by each of the panelists, and they will be invited to come to the pulpit for that response. They will be responding to one another, after which we will open up the forum for questions.
Let me respond first to Dr. Robeson. I am, I think, fundamentally in agreement with the burden of what he said in his response. I suspect, too, that much of the evidence that is produced is somewhat circumstantial and not terribly compelling. I see, too, that the elements of what is called magic in this book are not terribly important in the totality of Joseph's contribution. I would perhaps want to refine a couple of statements that he made, or at least ask for some clarification. It seemed toward the end of his presentation that he was suggesting that such things as seer stones and money digging were not, in fact, elements of Joseph's early life that he took seriously. It's difficult, I suppose, to know for sure what another person takes seriously and what one does not. I don't see any compelling reason not to believe that Joseph used a seer stone, believing that it was working. I see no compelling reason to think that Joseph dug for money, thinking that such treasures could be found. I think that there is no particular problem with any of those things, as long as we accept the fact that such things are not necessarily magical, except insofar as we ourselves have bought into a worldview that rejects them. Which now brings me to the points that were made last of all by Dr. Paul. It seems to me that the very presentation that he gave was a parade example of this mixing of the ritual with the magical, or the identification of the ritual with the magical, and referring to it rather as magical than ritual. I suppose here we may simply be playing with words. I don't, however, think that it's altogether unimportant, because these words, though meaning something to us that is fairly... We have a phone call for Jennifer Grosbeck. Jennifer Grosbeck, if you're here, please respond. Go to the gallery and respond. Daniel Rector's in the back. If you're in this audience, Jennifer Grosbeck, please go respond to the telephone call.
That's fine. In any event, the use of the term magic in place of ritual, I suppose, is acceptable, except that the meaning of the word magic is so value-laden in the minds of most people, certainly more so than the word ritual, and is so generally pejorative in connotation that though It may be used by Dr. Pohl here in a very positive way. He says it's too bad that there isn't more magic in Protestantism, if I'm remembering correctly. What he is saying is it's unfortunate that there isn't more ritual. I think, and I want to reiterate this point because I think that it is very important, the term magic must be defined in a way that is going to is not going to, one, reflect a kind of cultural imperialism or religious imperialism, and two, reflect the highest standards of objectivity in historiography. I think the trend in the last 25 to 30 years has been away from using the term magic as opposed to religion. It's been away from the early works of the 20th century of Malinowski, of Fraser, and of the late 19th and early 20th century by Tyler, to a recognition that, in fact, they belong together. And as Professor Penner, as I already mentioned before, might better be described simply as ritual, so as to avoid a word that has so many connotations that are so negative, and to begin looking at the nature of the actions themselves. Thank you.
I concur with Stephen Ricks that the word magic is maybe not the best term. It gives us so many difficulties. I also concur with he and somewhat with Dr. Robson and Dr. Pohl over Quinn's unevenness and thin evidence in many places. Plus, I think the point that he does not often give us guidance in interpreting some of this leaves us wanting, particularly to the lay reader. Let me say a couple of words about Kent Robson's response. 4 years ago, my son David Grossbeck went to Utah State University and just this year graduated in philosophy under the guidance of Professor Robson, and I can see now that I will have terrible difficulties in my home from now on. Sometimes you lose your children. Okay. I appreciate Dr. Robson's response, but I will pick up the challenge here and indicate first, in all fairness to Michael Quinn, his quotation of my paper on chronic depression for Joseph Sr. is probably the wrong paper. There are two papers, and there's some intermingling there, and I've got to check just exactly what I did put in about Joseph Smith Sr.'s chronic depression. Now, as a matter of fact, Kent, I'm glad you came to this conference, because Saturday in my paper I hope to present then, I want to really present the argument quite seriously about the Smith family, and particularly the chronic depression of Joseph Sr. Now, we'll see what happens after that paper, and I'm not sure whether Kent has seen it. I think there's a lot of evidence for it, as best as we can do. Well, maybe we'll see what that says. But as best as we can do from a psychohistorical point of view. Now, I'm sure that the psychohistorical approach may not ultimately satisfy people like Professor Robson, but I would like to challenge that position. And that brings me to another point about this. In psychoanalysis, in psychotherapy, it is true, we are not operating like historians, and our methodology is suspect out of the consulting room. When I see an individual whose life begins to unfold with dreams, fantasies, and all the non-rational sorts of things that every human being comes out with when they begin to free associate or reveal their dreams, we have to kind of look at what, in quotes, history means from another perspective. Jung coined a term called amplification. Now, amplification is probably what Hugh Nibley does a great deal of and what we've heard some comments about and what others do. Amplification is, I suppose, suspect in a strictly historical frame. But amplification seems to be part of a process that Jung describes as the evoking and flowering of a symbol. Jung was very different from all theorists in philosophy about symbols. He didn't just use the word symbol in the traditional way, that a symbol is something, object, idea, concept, feeling, whatever, that refers or stands for something else. Jung defined the symbol as the best possible expression of that which is yet unknown. And hence Jung found that in the myth-making capacity of the psyche, there seems to be an innate human need to create myth, create image, feeling, story, all that human beings seem to do. And Jung found that one of the most important curative, dynamic, and needful factors in human existence is to have a rich symbolic life. And so I would submit to you that Joseph Smith was one of these rare persons who was indeed a symbol creator. And so I guess from my perspective, when Michael Quinn takes some liberties other historians might not like to take, I submit that it's very helpful because it begins to enrich, in a way, the whole psychic process and experiences that someone like Joseph Smith is undergoing. And what's remarkable is, you see, we can take some of these experiences and make grand parallel comparisons to what happens to other human beings. And in that way, we can begin to build up an ontology of human behavior and how development occurs. I would like to coin a term that Jung called psychic reality. Psychic reality isn't what we might often say as, in quotes, outward true reality, and one always has to distinguish in responding to literally to what may come into one's inner psychic reality versus what's outside. Let me just read one paragraph from Edward Edinger, a follower of Jung, who said this. He talking about a dream. According to this mode of experience, i.e. in experiencing his dream in a primitively magical way, analogies are taken as realities. It is the method of associative analogical thinking. This is the way the unconscious works, by symbolic analogy. It is the principle on which our method of dream interpretation is based, amplification by analogy. It is completely erroneous to apply such a primitive mode in dealing with outer reality. That would involve us in magical and superstitious practices of all kinds. But it's precisely the right approach to deal with the unconscious and to make contact with the archetypal psyche, or this level of the psyche, which seems to produce what Jung called dreams or imagery from the collective unconscious. That is, imagery that comes from sources that are not just based on a person's experience. Finally, I would appreciate Dr. Paul's commentary very much. It's erudite and careful, and I think one of the best examples of the kind of thing I'm trying to point to is his analogy of writing prayers on pieces of paper for the temple and yet lighting candles somewhere else. Finally, I think there's an affective response I would make to all of us, and particularly perhaps philosophers like Dr. Robson, who are most comfortable in the rational world. And that is this. The history of shamanism tells us that once the shaman gets that original vision, complicated, vague, incomplete as it is, but dynamic and meaningful and powerful to the group of people it comes to, then the priests come along and have to tidy it up and make it beautiful and clear and religious. Both processes seem to be necessary, and I don't want to put a pejorative stamp on either one. We see Joseph Smith, the priest, doing that in the 1830s. But I just submit it for your understanding that if we're going to understand all of Joseph Smith, I think we're going to have to live with Joseph Smith, the shaman and the seer, as well as the prophet. And I think even Dr. Robson will have to do that too. Thank you.
The reason I've made Jess Grosbeck's life difficult is that I have been able to convince his son that Joseph Smith ought to be called a prophet rather than a shaman. That's the only thing, as near as I can tell, that I've achieved. And I think it's worth achieving, as a matter of fact. I liked Stephen Rick's initial attempt to distinguish between magic and religion. And I think that the comments he made along those lines were very helpful and ought to be applied to Richard Paul's comments as well. When he talks about writing something on a slip of paper, what he is talking about is the efficacy of prayer. And it seems to me that prayer is still very much an important part of religion and ought to be. And I take that seriously. But I don't think I take much in magic very seriously. Now, there are some practices that have clearly come down that I may occasionally do, although I don't put much stock in them. You know, I'm healthy today, and I hope I'll be healthy tomorrow. Knock on wood. I might do that. Do I think that that knocking on wood is going to ensure that I'm going to be healthy tomorrow? I don't put any stock in that whatsoever. And there are some things that might be interpreted as magical that I think more properly ought to be interpreted as religious, in some cases as ritual. If you want to call them magical, that's fine. But I don't think that's the right interpretation, and I suggest that we ought to follow Dr. Rick's suggestion that we ought to make a distinction between what is what and maintain that distinction. Now, I think that Stephen Ricks is absolutely right. I didn't wish to indicate that I didn't think that Joseph Smith was ever a treasure digger, or that he ever used seer stones, and that he never did so seriously. But it just seems to me, when you look at all the evidence, it turns out there just isn't much there, that the whole magical world view, when he did that, especially before 1827, that it had much influence on his subsequent activity, and that it didn't have much influence on all of the other things that he wrote and said. And the last thing I'd like to just briefly comment on is the word consistency. Over and over and over in the book, Michael Quinn would write, "This is consistent with something else." Now, consistency is a word that we use a great deal in logic. And all that it means is that if you take this along with something else together, there is no built-in self-contradiction between all of these views. However, everything that is true, anything that is true, would also be consistent. So it's consistent with everything he said in the book, to the extent it's true, to say 2 and 2 are 4, the moon is not made of green cheese, cows don't fly. All of those things are consistent with any other thing that he would want to say in the book. But after you say that this is consistent with that, you don't have very much. Because all that you're saying logically is we don't have a built-in self-contradiction if we try to put the two together. But that isn't much. Thank you.
I agree with the suggestion that Stephen Ricks made in the beginning, that Mike Quinn may have undertaken to make distinctions in some places where the distinctions are not all that clear. But it seems to me he has still undertaken a worthwhile enterprise, because it is a fact that Mormonism has, in the century, in the last century, moved into the rationalist stream of thinking about religion. I remember one of my favorite books when I was growing up with John A. Widsoe's A Rational Theology. And we have both explicitly and implicitly rejected the concept that magical components are somehow involved, although we acknowledge that the ways of God are still inscrutable to man. And since we have not, it was certainly present, or some of the things that were in those days labeled magic were present in the early days, and as I've tried to suggest, more than we care to admit, are still present in our own day, it seems to me an entirely legitimate undertaking to address the subject to which Dr. Quinn has given his attention. Certainly I must object, as a historian, to Professor Robeson's suggestion that if Mark Hoffman had never lived, this discussion would never have had any basis for occurring, because nobody thought about magic until Hoffman demonstrated some certain, if leisure domain be a part of magic, then he He introduced the one dimension which Quinn says he leaves out of his story. The matter of magic in as a factor in the environment and in the deportment of the early participants in the establishment of the church was raised by the Antis from the beginning. It's been a concern for scholarship, at least since the days of von Brody's biography, and many people were giving it attention long before the Hoffman documents gave a certain additional interest and a certain additional urgency to looking to see what really was there. It seems to me that this, in some respects, Professor Robson has been interested in making high school debating points. Certainly, in the suggestion that somehow in the illustrations I chose, I did not perceive any connection between the ordinances of the temple and the efficacy of prayer, it seems to me he was taking a cheap shot. To a considerable degree, we have, of course, been engaged in this in an argument about words. Now, if words did not have, like other symbols, emotional content, then I think we would agree that this discussion probably would not take place. But even as symbols have content, so that candles are not an appropriate way to manifest a prayer impulse, but slips of paper are. So words have content, emotional content. Prophet is a good word. Shaman is a bad word, or shaman. Seer is a good word, but interestingly, seer stone is a bad word. Religion is a good word. Magic is a bad word. Such a bad word that anything that you call magic, according to Professor Robson, is illegitimate. What Mike Quinn has done is challenge us to overlook these emotional responses to words and look at the substance. Now, if we want to agree, simply to put magic on the index and eschew its use in the language of discourse among Latter-day Saints, that's fine with me, as long as that doesn't discourage us from pursuing what is an entirely legitimate inquiry into the multifaceted and changing views and attitudes, practices, and understandings of the prophetic founder of this movement, to which I suspect 99.4400% of those here present have given their faith allegiance. Thank you.
Due to the flagrant disobedience of the panelists' members, we'll have precious little time to ask questions. And I'm going to start out with a question that need not be answered, but Jess, I'm very puzzled. If a symbol is the best expression of what is yet unknown, if it's yet unknown, how does Jung know that it's the best expression? That's all I want to know. We'll talk about that later. Let's get on to some serious questions. Yes.
Two questions. One had to do with the faculty of Abrac. And when you look at Lucy Mack Smith's statement, there is the possibility that maybe it doesn't, they weren't involved in that. There is the possibility that maybe they were, but what does it mean? And one of the interesting things is that Quinn himself suggests that the words may have been medieval names for God. And surely the Smiths were very much interested in calling upon God and communications from God and so on. Now, if you take all of the evidence that Quinn adduces concerning Joseph Smith's treasure digging, some of it indicates that he was pretty serious about it, especially during this early period, but some of it does not rule out the possibility that he was a hired laborer that he was simply along trying to earn money for his family. And that possibility has, I think, been overlooked for some of the kinds of cases where the treasure digging is described. I'm not trying to suggest that he may not have been a serious treasure digger, that he may not have taken it seriously, that he may not have used seer stones. But if you look at every instance that we have, some of them, it seems to me, can't be ruled out that he was simply going along because this is a way for him to make money for his family.
Other questions? Gene?
I'm happy to respond to that. It seems to me that that it all turns on words. The word shaman has, I think, for most people who are not anthropologists, emotionally negative connotations. The word magic has, for most people, emotionally negative connotations. Now, I'm not particularly sensitive, contrary to what I've said, to using the word magic. It wouldn't hurt my feelings if you wanted to call this a magical worldview that you were involved in last night. But I think I would prefer to call it, simply because of the negative emotional connotations of the word magic and of the word shaman, I'd prefer to call it, you were involved in religion, in giving a blessing, using positive emotional connotation words that would suggest, I think, more accurately, the reason that you did that. It's not that I'm afraid of the word magic, that I object to the title of the book. My frustration with the book is that the evidence for many of the claims that are made simply isn't there. It is really scanty and flimsy time and time again.
Paul?
It's a point of analysis that they... Well, let me ask the question again then. Jess Grossbeck affirms the definition of a symbol, saying that it is the best expression of what is yet unknown. My question is, if it's yet unknown, how do you know it's the best expression? Indeed, if it's unknown, how do you know that it's any expression of what you're talking about?
That's a good rational question. Jung used this distinction. For example, if you talk about the grove where the first vision occurred in Mormonism, I'm sure many of you have been there. And if you go to that grove and you say, aha, now I know that this grove is the place where Joseph Smith had this most sacred experience. He defined God, and God is such and such. And you now have the experience of this grove and a definition of God in your hand. You have what Jung would call a sign. He would say that you have not described a symbolic experience. However, if you go to the grove and you have evoked within you something you really can't put into words, you may not even be able to paint it, though that might be a better possibility than words. You may not be able to describe your experience, but it is an experience that Rudolf Ollo called the numinosum, the experience of the holy. Jung said, if you go to the grove and have the experience in that way, as I recall having many times when I was a missionary and still do, then you come to the point where you say, I can't explain it all. The grove, yes, it reflects this vision that Joseph Smith had. It reflects God, a definition of God, but it's something beyond that. It's something that you can't, well, but it moves me. It may move my whole life. It may move me to do things like go to foreign countries and talk to other people. You see, at that point, Jung would say, the grove, then, you see, is a symbol. It's an evoked feeling of mystery that goes beyond words and whatever. I suppose most art that really moves us would be in that same category. And I guess that would be the way I would say it, that the symbol then is something that still grabs you and moves you and carries you, and that's the power of it.
Thank you, Jess. Yes, the... I'd like to add to that question, if the nature of God also changed along with the rational change, was the nature of God and that that change in any way connected to the fact that we move from one to the other.
This is an interesting point, and I may change my answer after thinking about it a little more. But I don't think we have changed all that much, actually. And in citing, for example, the 82nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, I, the Lord, am bound when you do what I say. And the even more intricate set of obligational relationships suggested in the 132nd section, where if you do certain things, then all kinds of things become no more, all kinds of moral deportment become no more relevant to your ultimate celestial standing, because this act has conferred a special cachet upon you. And I think there is a good deal more of that. We are less rationalist in the liberal Protestant sense of the term, certainly, than we sometimes think we are. And God is someone who whose powers are exercised for his own reasons. There are certain ways when we can improve the odds that he will exert those powers in our favor. Now that, may I say, in so far as the relevance of all this to Mike's book, I think Mike may have undertaken to make a distinction where there is no difference, that he is dealing as a continuum, as somebody has suggested. And it's related to how much we know about why things happen, to how much understanding we may have of the part of the world and the psyche that we don't have rationally doped out. But basically, we still all see through a glass darkly, and the forms of Windex that we use to clear that view are sometimes ethical and sometimes only remotely related to ethics.
That's all we have, but before you go, I want to ask, is Michael Quinn present?
Let the record show that Michael Quinn didn't care enough about what we had to say to show up. That's all. He didn't care enough to come from California to be here today. Thank you.
This is the end of this cassette.